We're about to face the most difficult challenge we have ever attempted. No other crew would have a chance to pull this off. Let's give them a taste of what the Discovery is capable of.
I thought Klingons were honorable. Prove your worth.
I accept your challenge, human.
We have to abort now.
We don't run from a fight.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton playing roulette with my brain.
Clever. And we have a very special conundrum this week. We're going to talk about the mid-season finale of Star Trek Discovery, Into the Forest I Go, an episode title that once again I was fooled by. I feel like every time I've known the episode in advance, I take a prediction as to what character this applies to. Once again, I was wrong.
Were you convinced we're going to go back to Paavo and just walk through forests, literally?
I thought it was going to tie to Paavo as well as Burnham with the, kind of the fairy tale aesthetic and Alice in Wonderland.
Kind of the Lewis Carroll, like, illusions that we've been hearing about since the series started.
Yes.
So, Cam, as always, we want to tie the episode into a previous podcast episode that we did on the show. What are we doing this week, sir?
We're going to flash almost all the way back to the beginning of the podcast, back when Benjamin Young was a regular co-host.
Who?
And we're going to talk about badass moments in Star Trek.
Wow, okay.
That was an episode we talked about, for example, Best of Both Worlds, you know, the Riker fire moment. I mean, or the Jonathan Archer outrunning fire in Zero Hour. Well, this week, you know, we got to see Burnham aboard the Klingon ship, battling Cole with a knife, doing the slow motion dive and get the hell out of there.
She also cracked her, when you turn your head really quickly just to crack, like, the bones in there, you know?
Yeah.
Like her, whatever the equivalent of, like, spine knuckles would be.
Right.
She got the spine knuckle crack.
I mean, we've seen Burnham going on this journey through the first 9 episodes of Discovery. This was the moment where she crossed into, like, full-on badass, like, Ripley kind of moment.
Yeah.
You know, there was teases of it, kind of like in Context is for Kings, when she's, you know, running away from Ripper, that she was someone very capable in a sort of action scenario. But this was the moment where she crossed into that glorious Scott Bakula slow-mo running with fireworks behind a moment.
Is that the key to badass moments, Cam? Slow motion?
It helps a lot.
Because when we came back and we watched the destruction of the Ship of Death, the sarcophagus ship, that was all in slow-mo. We had Burnham and Tyler return to the bridge. That was all. There was a lot of slow-mo in that bridge sequence. I can understand it with regards to, like, doing the slow-mo transporter action, you know, while the Mechlith hits the ground.
Sure.
I'm not sure I was quite with the continued slow-mo all throughout this bridge sequence. It seemed like really, quite enamored with itself.
When Burnham did that dive over the railing in slow-mo, I was on board.
Do you think that's going to go down as one of the most badass moments of
the series? Or Star Trek? I mean,
it's up there, right?
We have no way of knowing how many moments like this we've got ahead of us with Discovery, because this is only 9 episodes into the first season. For all we know, this show is going to double down on badass moments.
But what was episode 9 of Star Trek The Next Generation? Was
Who knows?
Was there
I wish I knew.
We'll always have Paris? Was there a badass moment in there?
There might have been in the original series, maybe, in episode 9. I feel like that's when they were kind of figuring out the show. I don't think it's Miri, is it?
Sharpening pencils?
Episode 8 is Corbomite Maneuver, I think, so I don't know. But yeah, like, what did you think of this moment and sort of this scene, battling Cole for Burnham?
I kept writing down notes.
Yeah.
I think this might have been the best directed episode of Star Trek Discovery so far.
I was thinking the same thing.
You know, even though there were the slow motion on the bridge sequence, that actually had me rolling my eyes. But throughout the rest of this episode,
I was like in Con Air glory.
But throughout the rest of the episode, I kept saying, like, oh, Chris Byrne, he was the director of this episode. I was like, wow, like this guy's got a really good handle on how to create tension. And we've complained a lot about how this Klingon war doesn't really seem to have many stakes to it. We don't get the sense of scale to it.
Yeah.
I think with the last two episodes, they've really kind of fixed that issue. And I think with the directing on this, I felt tension throughout from the sequences within they board the ship. Tyler's having his PTSD issue going on. We also have
Cornwall can't move her legs.
Yeah. That would, so we do have a confirmation that Cornwall is alive.
Question for you. Is Cornwall the greatest admiral in Star Trek?
Okay. You know, so we were actually thinking about like, what are we going to do? How are we going to tackle this episode?
Yeah.
And we decided on badass moments. One of the things floating through my brain was, why do Star Trek admirals suck?
Yeah.
That was a topic that we tackled. And
that felt too jokey for the finale to the...
It did. Yeah, you know, it wasn't as kind of universal of a theme. But yeah. I really think that far and away, who is her competition? She has Nechayev and maybe Ross?
Not Ross.
But I mean, like, out of all the most prominent admirals?
I think maybe Pike in the new movies.
Okay, yeah.
That's the
so
only
let's
one.
Say Pike and Nechayev.
Yeah.
And that, so I think I really love Cornwall. Okay. Let's go back to her sequence with Tyler, because he's a guy who's suffering from PTSD, or as Burnham said, he had a violent encounter with the Klingons. Or no, a victim of Klingon torture.
Right.
And she's like, because it's already been established that she is a therapist, so she's like, oh, I've had patients like this. And she's trying to talk him through this PTSD that he's dealing with and trying to get him, like, breathe normally, exhale with a short breath there.
Right.
I'm like, I'm kind of in love with this Admiral character in a way that I've really not felt with since maybe Bruce Greenwood as Admiral Pike, right?
Oh, yeah. And not only that, she's doing, like, psychology while shooting a phaser. Like, why did Troy not get scenes like this?
That's a very good question. So who's the best kind of psychiatry sort of character, most badass psychiatrist, Cam? Is it Troy or is it Cornwall?
Well, I mean, Cornwall is the most badass.
Okay.
Because we never got to see Troy do stuff like this. You know, you had Face of the Enemy, which is really awesome in that episode.
Okay.
But
what about Ezri Dax in, what was the episode, Line of Fire? Or
she's got that gun that can see through walls?
Field of Fire.
Yeah.
That's pretty much like,
that is.
Up until this is maybe, you know, I still give the edge to Ezri with holding that ballistic weapon that can see through walls. That's pretty badass.
Well, you know, DS9, like this series, really like to underscore badass moments for the characters.
Yeah.
So you had Cornwall getting this moment, and a character who I really want to underscore because this is this, you know, he shares the scene with Burnham, Cole. Cole is a character that I've been really frustrated by going through a lot of this series because I feel like this character should be popping. And he's felt very generic leading up into this episode. We got such cool stuff with him, like picking his teeth with with Captain Georgiou's, you know, badge. I mean, how great was that?
And then he started wearing Georgiou's badge on his like uniform. Like we were like high fiving each other. We were like, wow, like another badass moment.
Yeah.
Like seriously, picking his teeth. Like, wow, okay.
It's moments like this I wish we'd had more of from this character leading up to this.
And because he's a goner now.
Yeah. Well, he was playing a similar role in this episode to the Reptiles Indy in Zero Hour, you know, who we'd seen throughout that season playing a much more prominent kind of dangerous role. But
did you ever care about that Reptiles Indy at all? Did you ever think, oh, he's going to be one of the all-time Star Trek antagonists? I think Cole is like
He does have a postage stamp.
No, that's true.
He does.
Canada Post, for all those who don't know, put out all these specialty Star Trek stamps, and they include a Zindi. And
it's Archer and the Reptile Zindi. Yeah.
And Gul Dukat gets one too, right? Wow. I need to buy those. You got some, didn't you?
Yeah, I got the set. Yeah.
Okay. I got the last year they introduced the 50th anniversary, and I've got like Scotty and Dr. McCoy. Anyway, sorry.
So you're saying like, did the Reptile Zindi ever become great? I don't know. He got a postage stamp, so he must be, at least when it comes to Enterprise, fairly iconic.
I think that General Cole is going to be remembered far more than the Zindi Reptile.
But is it all for this episode? Because I think leading up to this, Cole has actually been frustrating in that you had Voke and you had Laurel being really interesting and charismatic in their own way. And you had Cole who would kind of bark things, but he never had quirks.
But
in this episode, he had quirks that made him fun.
But you and I, we talked about it last week. We were like, we like Cole. We want to see more of him. We want to have more of these moments.
We got 45 more minutes.
I know, but well, that's it. Like we saw enough potential with him, like from the actor. And honestly, I just dig the cape. Like, give any alien a cape, and I'm sold right there.
Right.
So I'm really bummed. It's a good thing that I'm bummed that the guy's dead, right? It means like it's a character I wanted to see more of.
But unless... it's like they teased us right in his final episode. Like, I know. This character's really cool. Boom.
But they look, it's better than us not caring that he's gone.
That's very true.
So
very
true. It's a bummer on one parts. What a way to go out. You know, I'll say that. So, but this brings me to a big issue that I've had throughout Star Trek Discovery with the whole Klingon subtitles thing.
Right.
In which we actually had the Universal Translator going. Mm-hmm. They ditched the Klingon subtitles for his interactions with Burnham to, I think, the great benefit of this episode, in that I think it would have been really difficult for the actors to engage properly with each other if they're one is speaking in English, one speaking a made-up language. It totally 100% made sense. And I think Cole's never been better, partially because he's actually been speaking, or the actor's been speaking English. We get far more engagement with the actor speaking his native language, Kenneth Mitchell.
Right.
Cole's never been better. Can we agree on that?
No, I agree. This was his... He may have been my favorite part of this episode.
Okay, well, let's go.
I mean, and this was... Honestly, I think this was my favorite episode of the series. I mean, it's up against the second Harry Mudd one.
Let's get into our overall thoughts about this episode. Because throughout this, I was just like, okay, so far, I've liked magic to make the sanest man go mad.
Yeah, that's a real highlight of the series.
I think that's probably my top so far. I think after that it would be Vulcan Hello, and I think after that it's going to be Into the Forest I Go.
For me, it's magic and Butcher's Knife are the two that really jumped out.
So what is it about this episode that we're so kind of excited about? Because the big notable thing here is last week, the previous episode,
which I think may have been the weakest episode of the series.
I can't really argue with that. There might be one that I would feel would be a little bit weaker, but honestly, I think you're right. I think the Saru stuff fell flat.
Yeah.
But what is it about this episode that really, like, we're both digging? Like, we mentioned the direction. We mentioned the badass Cole moments, the badass Burnham moments as well. Yeah. Badass Cornwall. Like, how many badass Admiral moments are there in all Star Trek canon? Yeah.
We had badass Lorca moments.
Oh, yeah.
I was writing right off the top of my the episode in my notes. We had scenes on the bridge, you know, where, like, you know, Lorca is, like, giving, you know, speeches to his crew. And then they're, like, sitting there trying to figure out how to solve a problem. And I'm watching all these actors solve a problem on the bridge. I'm like, this is classic Star Trek. This is something the show has been missing for a long time, is people problem solving.
I wrote in my notes here, Cam. I'm just reading literally from my notes. Cloak caper. Then I drew like an arrow.
Yeah.
And then I wrote, characters equal smart. Writer not smart, but character smart. I love it when we get to see our characters be smart. I think we saw that a lot in Next Gen, where it's kind of the problem solving. And I love it when...
And I think at Next Gen, the one thing it did iffy sometimes was too much technobabble.
Oh yeah,
in those in those moments, but
we didn't have so much technobabble.
No,
in this. I got what they were doing. They're like, okay, we need two sensors, one on one side, one on the other side.
Like great in the way that, like, say, like Wrath of Khan would have a scene of like Kirk talking to Spock or whatever about something they've got to do. You know what I mean? Where you're just like watching two smart people bounce strategy off each other and then executing it.
So does this make sense from the creator's perspective that they're like, okay, mid season finale, it's not going to be about the dilemma of Paavo.
Yeah. Thank God.
Well, that was supposed to be... That was originally... Last week was actually originally supposed to be the mid-season finale.
Yeah.
Instead, I think we have, like, a far more action-packed, character-oriented sort of episode that I think, like, this is the way we leave it off. The cliffhanger here. Well, we have Stamets say, one last sport jump.
Yeah.
And you and I were both kind of looking at each other like, oh, this is kind of the... You know when the cop's about to retire... It's his last day on the job, and he shows a picture of his family, and then he gets shot in the head, you know, in that whatever film.
Or in a war movie.
In a war movie.
I got a wife back home, you know, it's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, we're like, oh,
Billy's
okay.
in some trouble, yeah.
So what do we make of this cliffhanger where they don't know where they are?
Well, the whole time I was watching the episode, it reminded me a lot of Zero Hour, obviously, the Enterprise finale to the third season, the Zindi War, as we referenced earlier. And you remember how that famously ended. We talked about that on our, I think, WTF or something like that with the alien Nazis showing
Nazi
up.
Nazi aliens,
You know, Archer's in a, where is he? this is very similar, where are they?
Should they have given us a little bit more of a hint other than all we really saw was a debris field?
You know where they are, right? We're not going to say on the air, but you have an idea as to where they
are,
right?
Well, why don't we talk about what we do know?
Yeah.
In that a few episodes ago, was it Leafy that we saw Stamets stare into the mirror? Or was it Butcher's Knife?
I think it might have been Choose Your Pain, actually.
This is why it's kind of difficult with the serialized storytelling. You and I, we're usually pretty good with our episode recall, but this is making it a little bit more difficult.
It was Choose Your Pain.
Choose Your Pain. Okay, yes. So Choose Your Pain, we have one, Stamets. I love, you're going to be an editing cam, and you're going to like go and backtrack and realize we've been like, oh yeah, it's definitely Choose Your Pain. It's going to be some other episode. Anyway, you know, we did have Stamets stare into the mirror.
Right.
Walk away, but his reflection remained.
Yeah.
So we know that there's some sort of mirror motif going on.
Right.
And we also had, well, we had Lorca and Stamets talking about all these parallel universes that this, my serial spore jumping gives them access to.
Right.
And Stamets is talking about how it's his last spore jump ever.
Yeah.
And now we end up in an error-prone spore jump. And we don't know where we are.
Right.
What does this mean, Cam?
I know exactly what it means, but I don't want to say anything.
For any listeners, I don't know. Let's be honest. Like we're probably getting at a lot of hints that maybe we're going to the mirror universe.
I think maybe a Star Trek actor has referenced such a thing.
Maybe. Perhaps. Yeah, maybe. So what do you think of the idea of Star Trek going to the mirror universe?
It was
going to
happen at some point.
Are you glad it's happening this early on, though? If it does happen,
you know what?
We don't follow spoilers,
we don't.
You know, this is speculation on our part. Although it's kind of to me, we kind of put two and two together.
Yeah. I mean, I think had talked a while ago before Discovery was really in any sort of shape to be a show that existed. That, you know, the mirror universe could be involved, because I know that was one of the early rumors or something way back when Brian Fuller was, you know, on board, and maybe before that, I don't even remember. It was way back. I think we blanched at the idea initially, like, why would you start a series and have that sort of thing? But I think at this point, these 9 episodes in, these characters are actually pretty well established, more so than most of the other series.
You know, I agree. Like, I would originally be like, oh, I don't know if we should be going to the mirror universe after only spending 9 hours with these people. But I think the thing that we've been praising the series most about is their grasp of the characters. And I think this early on, we have such a good, strong sense of the characters, save for one.
Like, you tell me there's an alternate version of Tilly, I'm like, oh, okay, I know what that is.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, you go to, like, first season TNG and tell me there's, like, alternate Geordi or alternate Worf, I'm like, I don't know what that means.
What about alternate Tyler?
Ash Tyler?
Yeah. Instead of trout, he really likes salmon? Is that it? I don't know.
Maybe.
Can we speculate a little bit if we are going into the mirror universe? And
yeah.
Listeners, we this is just speculation on our part.
Right.
We don't follow any spoilers.
I mean,
but
just the fact, you know, the final scene we see, they're in a place of debris. They don't know where they are.
Yeah.
We've seen this sort of thing before. Where are we? You know, it seems like it's a logical leap for, I think, most Star Trek fans.
Well, speaking of logic, let's talk, what would a mirror universe Burnham be like?
Oh.
Is she not a mutineer? Does she follow every order she's given?
I think so, right?
But
upbeat.
But she can't be like the kind of like stoic sort of character that she's been so far, right?
Well, like, I mean, mirror universe Burnham, I mean, has she trained in the Vulcan Academy? Probably not.
I don't think so.
She would have an entirely different life. Like, she wouldn't have gone through that whole training, so she wouldn't be kind of have those Vulcan-ish tendencies.
So she more of a Dr. McCoy kind of character then?
It's like possible.
A little bit more mercurial?
We don't really have any sort of background on what her family was like.
No, that's true.
So I don't know how she would have been raised. I mean, in the mirror universe, I figure nothing good happens, so
yeah, that's
true. You know, probably wasn't raised the best anyway. But
so wait. Mirror Universe Lorca, is he total like goody-goody?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Very demure, kind of like.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, I'm fascinated, Mirror Universe Saru, is he an apex predator? Is he like chasing, is he going at 80 kph to chase down prey?
You have to make him an aggressive character, right?
Yeah.
Like that's way more fun.
I would love him, you know, kind of. The biggest disappointment I ever had with the Mirror Universe was Mirror Universe Garak,
okay.
In which all the mystery was gone.
Right.
He was slimy, but he wasn't intriguing at all.
Right.
My biggest fear is that we don't get like a fascinating, like sort of charismatic sort of Saru, you know.
We haven't gotten one so far.
Okay. But the thing is with Saru is like you and I, we see so much potential in that character, and that's a frustrating part.
He might be the most frustrating character so far.
Yeah, and that like we like him, but we just have not been gripped by him, even though there's...
He gets scenes.
Yeah.
Like we've had scenes that were just dynamite of him and Burnham dueling against each other. But then we get like an episode dedicated to him with last week's episode, and it's like, that was pretty weak.
Okay, so Mirror Universe Stamets. Have we been getting glimpses of Mirror Universe Stamets?
I think
Stamets?
So, yeah.
You know, like he's kind of the groovy, way cool sort of Stamets.
I would say so, yeah.
Okay, what about Tilly? What is a Mirror Universe Tilly?
I think a more...
Self-assured sort of, or...
Self-assured, but more serious, I think.
Okay.
Serious and just kind of downbeat. Not the kind of the bubbly sort of life force of the ship.
Yeah, okay, but we joked about it. What is Mirror Universe Ash Tyler?
He's carefree.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I mean, this episode gave us the most Ash Tyler we've gotten this point. And the actor had a great monologue talking about his experiences being tortured by the Klingons. And I thought he did a really good job. Like, there was more emotion in that monologue than anything I've seen from Ash Tyler thus far.
I wanted to bring this up. I think this is the best Tyler moment that we got from the series so far, where it's like, I've always liked the actor.
Yeah.
I just don't know if they've given him much to work with. And I think here we finally, even though we had hints of it and they kind of spelled out, but when he was talking about like the sexual assaults, and then we actually saw the sexual assaults, which nowadays in Hollywood, it seems so much more topical than maybe it was when they were filming this, you know, 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So it's of its era, but I thought this is the best Tyler stuff that we've gotten so far. Do you see the way that we gripe about the potential we see in Saru that's a little bit unrealized? Do you see unrealized potential in the Tyler character? Do you think it's ultimately kind of a thankless role that he's been giving?
It's a different type of unfulfilled promise, because Saru, everything's there. All the elements are in place for a fantastic character. And it's more like they just aren't giving him the episodes or the time he needs to be interesting.
Right.
It's like he's interesting in small moments, but then they give him a full episode or more time, and you're like, man, what were they giving him? It's just not that interesting.
Yeah.
And whereas with Ash Tyler, he's getting a lot of screen time, and it's like they're just not giving him the quirks or sort of the interesting backstory that like a character like Saru has.
I mean, I joked about it a couple of weeks ago. Like, the guy needs like a hobby, like making paper planes or something like that. But like,
he got one, trout fishing.
That's true.
Which was not that far off in terms of ridiculousness as your paper planes.
But I would like to say that if we see him given depth with moments like this, he's nailing it out of the ballpark here. And I want to see more of this, but I just wonder how long could that be
a sustainable character trait, yes,
so to speak. You know, and I think it's a very important thing to address, especially when you think about like just all the conflicts going on in the world. And I mean, this is going back since man's been going to war, you know, 10,000 years ago.
Right.
So I wonder, is this going to be his most defining character trait 7 years from now if he's on the show? You know,
right?
You
that know. He's like the character with PTSD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I see potential in the character. I'm just wondering how, I don't know. I like the actor. I want more from the character. I think this has been his peak so far, and I only hope it gets better.
Well, I think it's a credit to Discovery that when we talk about characters like Ash Tyler, we're not saying, get rid of this character. Like, the actors are bringing something that we like, and they have a certain amount of appeal on screen, but we're frustrated by the lack of kind of definition or the lack of just juicy writing for them, versus like there's a lot of, say, like early season of other series, you'd be like, why is this character even on the show? Like, get rid of them. Like, they're just not that interesting.
If somebody told you get rid of one character from Discovery, it doesn't have to be a main cast member, but like somebody who's at least had a little bit of, you know, time on screen, who would you get rid of?
Oh, that's a tough question. Because they all fulfill a certain function on the show. Like, you know, you look at Worf in season one TNG. It's like, what is that character there for other than to maybe get beat up by aliens?
Would Worf have been an easy one to get rid of? in season one TNG?
He would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that made him distinct was the fact it was a Klingon on the ship, which was really cool to have. It's just that they didn't have a function for him.
Did he even get like a... Was Heart of Glory in season one
it
or was that
yeah.
season two?
I think it was season one.
Okay. So that was his one... That was his only Worf-centric episode of the entire season, right?
Yeah.
That was like 26 episodes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He was very much just kind of shuffled off to the side a lot. But I'm trying to think of Discovery.
I'll give you my answer.
Okay.
And maybe this could spark some inspiration from you. Which
yeah.
I like to inspire you, Cameron.
Sure.
Speaking of Klingons, and it's already come to pass, but I think I don't know how sustainable a character T'Kuvma could have been 9 episodes in.
Right.
As kind of like the
religious
zealot.
I kind of griped about that. Why would they get rid of this character in the first episode? I think it's mostly worked.
Yeah, and we both like the performance of the actor Chris Orbee, who's doing T'Kuvma. I just don't know if that was going to be sustainable. I think the character would have gotten old, where he's just talking about like... how you have to be a religious zealot, or Cole calls them, torchbearer fools. I love that term.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I'll throw it back at you.
Any
character, maybe you'd say, okay, you got to get rid of one.
I mean, obviously, I got to get rid of Ash Tyler and Keith Landry.
Is that it? Yeah. All right.
No, I mean, God, like they,
Milton Richter.
Oh, he wasn't even on this week, was he?
He hasn't been on since Sanest Man.
No. The thing is, like, they've done a good job in that, like, characters like Arium or Milton Richter, they are such background characters that they don't have that issue where they're standing prominently on the show and you're like, who is this character and why do they not serve a function on the show? Like,
but, you know,
I think, you know, the one that maybe... And this is maybe like kind of a cheap one to pick, but it's frustrating because she's there, and that's Kayla Detmer. This is a character we feel like should really contribute something to the show, given her background.
She's been in every single episode.
And she was on the Shenzo.
Yeah.
Which you'd think would cause some sort of dramatic sparks, but the fact that we go week after week just seeing this character blankly staring out a screen.
And going, aye.
Yeah, contributing nothing. I find that frustrating.
Well, let me pitch this to you.
It's like if you remove that character, it removes that issue of being like, why is this character here? And why are we not being kind of giving some sort of payoff to the Burnham relationship, you know, being on the Shenzhou? Why do we not have a scene of Kayla Detmer even talking to Saru?
Do you think out of all the episodes she's done, this has been actually her strongest outing? I think she actually kind of popped during this episode.
She had more to do. Yeah. Just
yeah.
It being a very like bridge heavy episode.
But it's like kind of more expositional stuff.
It's a thankless job for the most part.
But let me pitch this to you, Cam.
Yeah.
A Lower Decks episode that is a Tilly-centric episode where we get to learn more about Reese or Bryce or Detmer or Joanna or, you know, even Culber to a certain degree.
Yeah, I would love that.
I would totally. And I
could see the show doing that, too.
I would love it because they've already done kind of their cause and effect homage.
Yeah.
In which they take the basic concept of kind of the repeating time loop.
Yeah.
But they do it in their own way. They make it a different tone, which I think was genius on their parts. And that's probably why it's... Do you think that's still maybe our favorite episode of the season? Like, I think for me, it's still the high watermark, but
I'm
what about
you? I'm going to have to rewatch this one before I decide.
Okay. Okay, fair enough.
At this point, I'm leaning towards this one.
Okay.
But it's close. It's very close.
It is, yeah. Isn't it exciting to watch an episode and you're about, like... halfway through and you're like, I think this might be my favorite episode so far. I just hope they can stick the landing, you know?
The one thing I will say about the magic to make the Sanest Man go mad is that it felt, even though it was a cause and effect sort of riff, it in some ways felt like one of the most original Star Trek episodes we've gotten in a long time in terms of its tone, in terms of like the lightness, you know, the crew having the party on the ship. Like, we haven't seen that before.
No.
And
it seemed original in a way.
Yes, whereas like this episode, I could say, well, we've seen things like this before.
Help me out with my blog, Cam. I want to know what I should be doing for the blog this week.
Yeah.
I think by the time most listeners listen to the podcast, they'll know what I'm doing for the blog. But I'm still kind of scratching my brain. You and I, we discussed maybe some potential episodes to tackle. It might be a bit of a challenge, but we'll see. So if they did a Lower Decks sort of episode... You know, and we saw that on Voyager with Good Shepherd, which I think Good Shepherd might be one of those kind of underrated episodes.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to tackle this in a different way. I totally think that the...
We should say Good Shepherd is the one where Janeway goes on the away mission with, like, kind of newer
cadets and ensigns. I think it was, like, three people that had actually never been on an away mission before, and and she just finally realized that. She's like, I better take them on an away mission. And yeah. I really dug that episode.
I really am a big fan of that episode,
yeah,
too.
So I would have to think, like, okay, so we've kind of done this before, and I... They would tackle this in a different sort of way, right? So I would love to get more out of, like, Commander Arium.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by Arium. Ever since I lost Landry in my life, Arium has taken her place in my favorite character, who I'm just like, I want to know more.
But this is a good thing that we have so many background characters that just seem intriguing, seem to pop, that, like, we want to know more if they devote an entire episode. And I think...
And how often on TNG did you sit there and go, I want to know more about that background character?
Well, remember the woman who did the con most of the time? Like,
after Tracy Coco?
No. After Michelle Forbes left the series, there was an actress who did it. Joyce... I'm blanking on her last name, but Joyce something. Woman of color.
Right.
I know her so much because I actually watched her on The Amazing Race, like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
She and her husband were amazing. Like, right. I loved watching. They actually ended up winning this season.
Oh, interesting.
Spoiler alert. But yeah. But all she did was said, like, yes, I'm going to 101.3 Mark 4, 5, 9. And like, that's all she did. I don't want...
I often found, like, the side characters, or the, you know, the basically the background crew members... kind of like wallpaper on the other series. Like, they didn't really stand out to me at all.
Okay, you know, I'm gonna argue with you just a little bit here. We did get Chief O'Brien.
Right.
That's...
He actually had more... It seemed like more to do, though. He just... It felt like, in the sense, like, the camera felt focused on him in a way it wasn't a lot of the rest of them.
But you know what? Like, there was a lot of episodes where, like, they actually paid Colm Meaney to do this. Like, really? Just to say, beaming up.
Right.
Like, and you know...
Did you care about that character then? Or was it more like once they put him in charge of the transporter that he suddenly became a character you kind of were like, oh, I'd like to know more about him?
I think he was only on the Battle Bridge con, like, for one episode, the encounter at Farpoint, and I think they ended up putting him in the transporter room after that. I could be mistaken. My affinity for one Chief O'Brien, it did not come from watching Encounter at Farpoint.
Right.
You know, it's probably like three seasons in, you know, which is more than I can say for Arium, who I'm just like, no, I want to know more about Arium at
her
this point.
Her first appearance and context is for Kings. I'm like, give me more Arium, please.
But, okay, so we hop over to...
I'm hoping in the upcoming... whatever, I can't remember the name of it, generic name, Discovery novel, that that character features prominently.
Does it have the word desperate in the title?
No, that was the first one. Desperate Hours and I think Drastic Measures.
Drastic Measures. Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah. So we do have a bit of a cast of characters, of side characters on TNG. We have Guinan, we have Barclay, we have O'Brien. Am I missing any? Well, we have Ogawa.
Ro is a side character.
We have Ro, we've got Nurse Ogawa.
Yep.
Keiko O'Brien to a certain degree, you know, there's a couple you can pick out of.
Yep.
DS9, that is, like, just rife with all these kind of, like, lower decks kind of characters, like a Rom, for example.
Sure.
You know. Voyager, then I agree with you. Like, who are the, we have a friend, one Stefan Estanil. We're asking him about, first Star Trek crushes.
Yeah.
What was the name of the character?
Was it Ensign Tibor or something like
It was like, it was a Bajoran ensign.
Don't quote me on the name. It was something along those lines, I believe.
It was a very kind of generic sort of Bajoran
name. He was in like one or two episodes, maybe?
I think he was in two episodes. And
I'm not even sure he spoke.
No, he did speak. As soon as Stefan brought this character up, I was just like, him. You know, but I was just like, okay, Stefan, you know, if... obviously, like, sparked some interest there, but, like, it was such kind of a generic character to me.
Right.
Who else? We got, like, Naomi Wildman.
Yeah.
Samantha Wildman.
I mean, there was...
Joe Carey.
There was the Vulcan. Was it Vorik?
Tarek was on Lower Decks, and I think Vorik
was on Voyager. Vorik had actually some things to do on the show, so he wasn't total background.
Oh, we had Seska.
Yeah.
We had Mike Jonas, your favorite.
Of course.
Who else did we have? Is that it?
I think that pretty much covers it.
Mike Jonas did not get to jump onto Enterprise as a spin-off character like O'Brien did.
No.
Or like Keiko did.
No.
And they wanted to do that with Ro, too.
It just doesn't seem like the other series were interested in having characters on their bridge that felt like they could be leads of their own series. Or not leads, but like members of an ensemble of their own series. Right. Whereas like Discovery does. I feel like the characters that are populating the screen with feel like characters who could pop. If there was an alternate Star Trek series, they could be on it. Like, so, kind of like, actually, almost like the J.J. Abrams movies, where he would put, like, there's the character played by, I think it was Joseph Gatt or something. Sorry if I got the name wrong, but he played, like, the, was it, like, the cybernetic guy
I know who you're talking about.
Into Darkness. Like, that felt like a character who could have a prominent role in an alternate, you know, in a side movie that doesn't exist.
So, okay, let me pose this, because I think we kind of get the feeling that maybe not all of the characters that are listed in the main credits will be making it to season two.
Yeah.
So, do you think that what they're trying to do is do kind of the slow burn with some of these characters we've been seeing in the background, and some of them might kind of, I'm not saying they're going to get in the main credits, but they might rise to more prominence in season two, just because I think they want to establish these main characters and then let the secondary characters flourish in later seasons.
The only thing that makes me think the answer is no is the fact these characters aren't being given any sort of character moments.
I know. You're right.
And not, I mean, you could say like,
I don't know. We know that Reese can't really shoot.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say, like, there was a scene of, like, Detmer and Milton Richter, like, making out in magic, that makes the sanest man go mad. But, like, they're not being given sort of any sort of personality.
So are they doomed to just be generic expositionary characters?
I hope not.
Yeah.
Because I just don't know why you put someone like Arium on the bridge and just don't give her anything.
I think, you know what? What's going to happen, though, is they're going to be, the writers are going to be looking at feedback from fans. And I think they're just going to be watching the dailies and be like, oh, wow, that character pops. Let's give them more to do.
I feel like Arium is like the Boba Fett, where it's like this character they kind of create on a whim just to have like a line of dialogue. And people are just like, it just captures their fascination.
Well, do you ever think we're going to get a return of Daft Punk from the first two episodes?
I knew the name of that character from the book, actually. But it's like Naomi or something.
Did they ever like establish what Daft Punk was all about?
Yeah, it's like a virtual reality helmet that she has to wear.
She like an alien or?
That
she...
I don't know. I don't know about that. They didn't.
But her
name's
Naomi.
It was a weird spelling though. Don't ask me the background on the character because it didn't really give any. It just gave a last name and it talked more honestly about the helmet than it did about the character.
Was the last name Wildman?
No. Okay. No, it was different spelling. But I think it was like N-Y-O-M-I or something like that.
Oh, so it could be kind of like maybe an alien or something.
Could be.
We were never really sure because was it a cyborg or what? I'm intrigued by Daft Punk, but look, it's been 7 episodes since we saw Daft Punk. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, did she ever make it past the Shenzo?
All we know is that we saw her being taken to sickbay.
Oh, okay.
Made it further than one Ensign Danby Connors.
The helmet didn't make it, I guess.
You can get a new helmet.
Maybe she's been on the Discovery the whole time and we just didn't realize without the helmet.
Oh, wow. Maybe that's Arium.
Like, do they... Because we didn't see in other Star Trek series characters walking around in virtual reality helmets.
Was in the game. In the game.
Well, sure. But is that exclusive to the Shenzo?
It could be.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. So... Why don't we go wind back just a little bit to what we were talking about earlier?
Let's talk about the character of Laurel.
Okay, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. What is going on with Laurel and Voke right? Or I'm sorry, Laurel and Tyler right now.
Well, I mean, Voke we don't know because it's been a while since he was on there.
A very prominent character. It's been five episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What's going on with Laurel and Tyler? Let's talk about this. Okay, you know what? We talked about the F-bombs on Star Trek.
Yeah.
Let's talk about nudity in Star Trek.
Sure.
We got our first glimpse of nudity in Star
Trek.
What
is this nudity?
Well...
When it's all prosthetics, is it nudity?
I would say yes. Because, is it okay? You know, like, obviously the actress, Mary Chifo's, she's obviously in, like, a bodysuit.
Yeah.
You know, she's... But do you think people are going to be upset by the idea that we are seeing an alien naked in Star Trek?
Have we seen this before?
I'll
the closest I can think of, and it wasn't naked, was the dancing cat lady in Star Trek V.
It was close.
Close, yeah. It was kind of like a stripper or go-go dancer, whatever you want to say.
Let me just say this, and I'm not taking any unfair jabs at any particular nationality or anything like that, but I grew up in the United States.
Yeah.
And down there, I find that violence, not a problem.
Right.
Like, in media.
I would even say here to a certain degree, too, in Canada.
In Canada as well. You know, people don't really have a problem with violence in media. But in the United States, if there's, like, sex or nudity in media, people really get, like, up in arms. And
right.
But it's funny, because Canada, yeah, not so much with violence, they don't care. And same with sex and nudity. Like, I don't think people in Canada care so much. Maybe, probably more so than in, like, Europe or whatever.
Right.
But, I mean, it, not the way that they are in the United States. So maybe we're just depraved culture here in Canada. Maybe that's what the deal
Something in the water.
Yeah, so I wonder if maybe more American families watching this together will get more up in arms. But honestly, like,
Why are families watching this show at this point? They're just like gluttons for punishment if they're continuing to watch it.
Okay. What did we really see, though? Is it anything worth, like...
No.
My only issue, though, is... And I do have issues with the scene in that we are watching sexual assault, but it's kind of portrayed in a sensual manner. Is that true?
Yeah.
Which makes that does...
It's tough to talk about.
Okay, but do you think this flashback that we see, was it meant to be a depiction of sexual assault?
I don't know.
Because
that is my honest answer is I don't know, because I don't know where this character is going. And we see this ends on a very ambiguous note between these two characters.
For anybody who's super, I'm a super spoiler averse person.
Yeah.
I've not been viewing spoilers. I've stayed away from them. But for anybody who
And to be fair, there aren't spoilers out there for where the series is going.
You know, they've been really locked down on this.
It's been fan theories,
so this
not
is
spoilers.
Fan theories. But if anybody's as spoiler averse as I am, then maybe skip ahead 3-4 minutes.
Yeah.
And 1, 2, 3, 4 potential spoiler time. Okay.
Right.
So Cam, the big fan theory is like Voke equals Tyler.
Yeah.
And before this episode started, Cam, I turned to you and I said, you know what? This Voke equals Tyler theory, I think the writers are just trolling us. They want to make it so obvious that they're going to go and just trying to bug us, and we're all going to think that it's actually Voke equals Tyler, when in fact, no, it's not that. And that's going to be the big twist, is like Voke and Tyler. I think I 100% think that Voke is played by the same actor that plays Tyler.
Definitely.
That does not mean that they are different characters. Or that
they are the same character.
Like, I don't think they're the same characters. But we're really getting a lot of messages sent to us that seem to indicate that Voke and Tyler are the same characters as of this episode. Where do you fall down on
this? Well, when they were showing the torture footage, right, where he's having his PTSD episode, I'm thinking that's hit the transition.
Well, exactly.
Yes.
So we saw like scalpels and buzzsaws.
And we've seen Laurel with the Admiral before. And she doesn't strike me as someone who just wants to torture people for fun.
No, it's,
we haven't gotten that off that character.
Oh well, no, but she has established herself as the interrogator.
Sure, but
in what way? I buy that.
Is it just that she's more like she's smarter than people?
That could very well be it, because she did talk to the Admiral and she got what she wanted from the Admiral, right?
Yes.
So
she's deceitful. She's not violent. That's the thing I've gotten mostly from this character.
So where are we going with Laurel and Voke? Laurel and Tyler.
Well,
at
and
this
there
point.
Were sparks between Laurel and Voke too earlier on too.
Yeah, well, episode 3, Consciousness for Kings. That's when they had that really good conversation where Laurel is like, "I can be your champion."
Yes.
And that's still one of my favorite Laurel moments.
Right.
You know, where it's established like she does not want to be the person in power. She wants to be kind of the puppet master, essentially.
Right.
So, Laurel is now in the brig.
Yeah.
Tyler is going to the brig, and Laurel is telling Tyler, hey, everything's going to work out. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Don't worry. What do you make of this, Cam?
I think the fan theories are correct.
Like Voke equals Tyler?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think...
I
don't think he knows who he is, though.
No, well, that's just it, because before this episode started, I was like, well, okay, I don't want Voke to be Tyler. I think maybe the writers are trolling us, but if he is, I think he's a sleeper agent.
Yes.
And I think if that's the case, I think this episode kind of confirms that he is a sleeper.
Yes.
So what do you make of that idea as kind of a character with conflict going on?
Well, okay, you know, one of the issues was that this character was presented in a way where he was too good to be true. He was a character who was kind of blank on the surface. And I think that this could be really...
You mean like Madonna in
in Dick Tracy.
Dick Tracy.
Obviously, that's completely the reference I was going for. He's going to sing torch songs.
Yeah.
But no, because actually, you know what? I actually think there's something interesting to this that we'll see if it goes this way. But Star Trek is all about, you know, the being pulled to like higher ideals. If he is a sleeper cell type character, is there then a conflict between being pulled to the Klingon side versus what Burnham represents and maybe what sort of the hopefulness of this crew represents?
The only reason I could be on board with this Volk equals Tyler twist is because it would be the sleeper agent side where he becomes a conflicted character in which he's like, oh, wait a minute, I understand the Federation better. I'm locked in with Burnham, for example.
It could even be a backdoor way of having a Klingon on the crew that's never known to be a Klingon.
Do you think we're going to go 7 seasons where his identity is not revealed to the rest of the crew?
Well, we'll see.
I'm not convinced Ash Tyler
is long for this world.
Is long for this series.
Right.
So,
Here's the question. Did Laurel want to be caught?
Yes, I think it is. I think she did.
I think we are seeing the Joker / Loki trope that this character wanted to be caught.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's also in a prison cell where they can taunt people.
Okay, yeah, but you say that like a lot of factors had to come together for this plan of hers to work out.
As it did for the Loki and the Joker.
I know. But it makes me roll my eyes. I'm just like, well, you're very lucky, Laurel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she did get... Does she still have the face tattoo? Or I guess the war paint that's...
I don't know. She didn't have the paint on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well...
Okay. I'm loving Laurel, though. Laurel is a character who I would be more than happy to see go for seasons.
Is she our favorite secondary character at this point?
She's mine.
She's mine.
Yeah.
So, I'm Arium, very close. Even though Arium's given us nothing.
I would actually put Laurel over some of the major cast.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about side characters a little bit. We talked about Cornwall.
Yeah.
I'm digging Cornwall. I'm digging Laurel. I hope Volk comes back at a certain point.
Sure.
Because when Volk was around, I really liked him.
Yeah, me too.
Who else jumps out to you?
Harry Mudd has been interesting in the 2 times they've used him.
I liked him far more in the second time.
I liked him in both in the sense that we've never quite seen this.
Okay.
It felt interesting in a way.
My complaints about Harry Mudd.
Well, sure, the baggage associated with the character. But
far documented. I don't need to go into it.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, I like what Discovery is doing with that character,
okay.
I'll say.
Okay.
I think he's interesting removed from the original series completely.
So what about Sarek?
Sarek, as I've said before, has yet to grow on me.
Okay. I thought he was... I'm a bigger fan as of Leafy than you are.
Yeah.
What about Admiral Terrell?
Yeah, Admiral Terrell doesn't really.
He's got
offer
a little bit
a
of a bit of a
Tuvok thing, you know. And I'm not saying that because he's a black actor playing a Vulcan, more because he's written in the way that drove me nuts with Tuvok, where it's a Vulcan with no personality.
But whereas, okay, we got that with Saval for a long time,
yes.
And then suddenly by season 3 or season 4 of Enterprise, he's just full of personality. I see potential with Admiral Terrell.
Sure, but I didn't care at all about Saval until he got interesting.
Okay, okay. To me, I would say that there's a bit of a spark or a bit of a pop with that Admiral.
The fact that they bring him back tells me that there's something there they like about him.
I think he's more interesting at this point than Admiral Ross was.
What about Brett Anderson?
Terry Serpico?
Yeah.
Do you know? Okay, I don't know if you ever watched John Oliver's show. So he had this segment on recently about, he was talking about this show on CBS that airs every Saturday morning as part of their, I guess, oriented towards children's programming or whatever. Okay. Terry Serpico plays a U.S. postal inspector on this show that is not financed by CBS, but financed by the U.S. Postal Service.
Okay.
And Terry Serpico is playing what's supposed to be, like, in a totally, like, straightforward, dramatic role, a badass U.S. postal inspector. It is embarrassing to watch. And I feel bad for the actor. And that, like, it was a thankless admiral role that he had. Yeah. But I think the actor had enough, like, spark to him. I had previously stated on the podcast that I liked him from Rescue Me.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the actor at this point.
You know, it's just, you never know with a Star Trek series if you're going to get a role that really means a damn, because there's so much secrecy around it. I don't even know if the actors knew what they were going to be doing on the series.
Like, I bet, but you know, by
were
the
they
time,
even privy to the
no, but if you sign your contract,
yeah,
you're like, okay, well, I'm in two episodes, and what does that really mean?
Do they know that? Do they find that out?
Well, if you sign a contract, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, you hear all the time about actors not knowing they were going to be written out of a series, where the writers broke it to them or killing you.
Well, yeah, but I think that's kind of a, you can read the writing on the wall just by looking at your contract to a certain degree. Because I think for that, like, the actors are still going to get paid, even if they're, let's say you're a regular actor on Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And you've been on since season one and you're killed off midway through season three.
Right.
You're probably going to get paid all the way into the end of season three.
Right. Okay.
That's look, and I'm talking as somebody who's not at all involved with Hollywood.
Right.
Anyway. So, these side characters, where were we going here, Cameron? With how they're popping,
yeah.
Laurel, Voke, all this sort of interesting
stuff. Well, I mean,
stuff.
It's almost at the point, like, is Laurel a side character? Her role may be more prominent at this point in terms of how important she is to where the show is going than Saru.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Which is disappointing, but...
Like, what did Saru contribute this episode? He has the moment where he's going to, like, kind of disagree with Lorca about the Povins, and that
he helped out with the cloak caper.
And that's sort of like an exposition-type moment. Like, it's not like a character moment. You know, the only real character moment we got is him saying, like, let me appeal to the Admiral about the Povins. And I'm like, oh, brother. Even Lorca wasn't even listening to him.
I know.
Like, enough with the Povins.
Well, one of the reasons I kind of dig Lorca as...
Lorca had his Independence Day moment. Did you notice that, where he had his big, like, Bill Pullman speech?
He's like, you guys started here as scientists, yeah, and now you're all fierce warriors.
We will not go quietly into the night.
I'm fascinated by, like, I feel I should be more conflicted about Lorca as a character, and that he's clearly, like, off the rocker to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I think Jason Isaacs brings so much to this role that, like, I'm kind of like... I can understand why people would fall under his spell and why they would totally buy into what he's saying here.
Well, let's talk about a dynamic, actually, that was interesting on this episode, is that we saw a lot of Lorca with Stamets.
Okay,
Which I thought was actually interesting to see, because there's a scene where we find out Lorca's been keeping basically sort of like a map, essentially, of the potential universes that have been uncovered by the Spore Drive and all their various trips they've made. And, you know, Stamets says, like, I didn't think you cared. Like, it shows that Lorca, there is an interest in exploration. Like, he's not just a warmonger, because early on with Stamets, he said he's just a warmonger.
Right.
In Context is for Kings. And now we're seeing, like, he's surprised, like, oh, you actually do care about scientific exploration. Are we going to see a bit of a turn for Lorca where there is an explorer in him?
No.
You don't think so?
No, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Don't you think it was a little curious that just as Stamets goes and hits the Spore Drive, we actually get a shot of Lorca pulling up his console and flicking through buttons?
Right.
Do you think Lorca may have been responsible for this error that happened with the Spore Drive?
Ooh, I didn't even think of that.
Because the thing is, I was genuinely surprised when Stamets... I love the moment between Lorca and Stamets when they're in the... I think it was the shuttle bay, and they're... gorgeous shot.
Yeah.
And they're, like, looking over the Pavo.
It reminded me of Empire Strikes Back, the final shot of Luke and Leia.
Yeah, I get that. And then Stamets breaks it to Lorca. I'm never doing another spore jump after this.
Right.
And Lorca's like, okay.
Yeah.
Do you think Lorca is going to be happy if the whole reason, like, the Discovery's most prized ship of the fleet is because of the Spore Drive?
Yeah.
And they take that away from Lorca?
Yeah.
Look, Lorca was happy to send Admiral Cornwall off to one General Cole.
It's true.
We should probably address that fact that she's headed back to good health at Starbase 80 something or other.
Sure.
But I kind of wonder, like, Lurka's not going to go quietly into the night where, like, I have access to something that makes me important.
Right.
You know, I kind of think that Lorca might be responsible for it when he took place. It just seemed like such a weird shot.
It did.
And that, like, Lorca was pushing buttons.
Well, and it seems to go against everything we've learned of the character thus far as well.
Yeah. Where, didn't you find it odd that Lorca was like, oh, this is your last one? Oh, okay, I understand.
Well, it was also odd that, you know, Lorca is going to be recommended for, like, an award for his service in the Klingon War, and he ends up saying, like, I'm going to give it to you, Stamets.
I kind of like that.
I like it too, but
I kind of, I kind of bought it, though. Like, I think that he was being genuine. This is before Stamets said, I'm never doing another Spore jump again. I did actually buy that on the surface level.
Lorca looked pissed off when he found out he was going to get that award. He did not look happy at all.
Like, he didn't look happy that he was like going to get the award?
He did not look that, like, oh, thank you very much. He didn't seem very gracious about it. He didn't look that thrilled that that he was being informed of this. And I wondered,
I didn't notice that, but what do you think that would signify to you?
Is it that the idea of, like, they're going to promote him or something? Like, he could be up for a promotion to Admiral? He doesn't want to be drawn back to accept this award? Like, I don't know. I was wondering what this
meant.
I'm
sure he could decline an Admiral promotion. The other thing is, this Klingon War, what they're saying is, oh, it's coming to an end thanks to what the Discovery crew did with regards to these invisibility screens.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know.
Is this the end of the Klingon War in terms of being a driving force of the narrative for the series?
I think if we are going to a different universe, I think it's not going to be for one episode.
We only have 6 episodes left in the series.
So do you think I have maybe at least 2 episodes in another universe and then...
Yeah.
And then we come back to the Klingon, like tidying up the Klingon War?
Maybe there's another standalone somewhere along the road. And then we've got, you know... I mean, I don't know. The thing is, you've now... killed Call. Laurel is trapped, so anything she's contributing is stuff aboard the ship, like sabotage and things like this. She's not tied into the war.
Yeah, who's the Klingon antagonist at this point?
There is none. Except for maybe Voke.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, Voke is the only character with a question mark next to him, and he's not in a position of power in the war either. So the war is now faceless Klingons versus faceless Federation, and our ship out of commission.
No, we have Admiral Terrell.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
There you go.
And so, no, I really do feel like there's nothing left to this Klingon War for us to be invested in.
I totally see that perspective, but I just...
Like, do you think in the last 6 episodes they're going to introduce new Klingon antagonists to pay off in a finale?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
No, we do have Dinesh. She's the one who's wearing the jewelry in her face.
Okay, yeah.
So she's still out and about.
Character offered a lot.
Yeah. And I have to believe, like, there's, like, a House Gorkon, a House Chang.
We could have a Kor out there.
Well, Cole was in House Kor.
Yes.
Although, I wonder if they don't want to introduce Kor just because of how drastically different he would look.
It's possible.
So, and they keep saying that whatever continuity errors you seem to think of, they're all going to be explained by the end. I'd like to cling on to hope that they're going to explain why the Klingons look so drastically different, and maybe it has to do with that augment virus that they introduced 100 years ago, and that's why the Klingons and the Federation really didn't make much contact for the previous 100 years.
Yeah.
I digress. So, but with regards to this Klingon War, it seems to be in wind-up mode, but does that even make sense? Like, oh, we've cracked the code for these invisibility screens. That means the war's over? That doesn't really jive with me.
It doesn't, but we've complained the whole series so far that the Klingon War is not really meaning much.
Yeah, I know.
And so, it may... Like, because if you look at this episode was a bookend to the Vulcan Hello and Battle of the Binary Stars, where you had Berman back aboard the Klingon ship,
going up
against the Klingons after she's killed T'Kuvma, coming back saying, you know, I'm the one that killed T'Kuvma, taking down the leader of the Klingon army again.
Yeah.
Where else do we have
to go? She's 2 for 2.
Like, this was the bookend. I don't know where you go at this point that would offer anything more satisfying.
She's going to end up on a mirror universe version of the Ship of Death.
T'Kuvma's back.
Yeah, T'Kuvma and Cole.
Yeah.
And Dinesh.
Hey, I'd be down for that.
Sure.
But, I mean, it does feel like in terms of the Klingon War, I think you could have an episode maybe about why the Klingons kind of go away, or sort of about the war ending, signing a ceasefire or whatever, but I don't know that there's that much more to do.
I get where you're coming from, but I honestly think it's going to be very easy for the writers to come up with something to do, though. Like,
right.
I'm not convinced that this is the end of the war, even though they said it. That just does this episode actually seem like, oh, this is what we've been building up to and this is the conclusion of everything?
In some ways, it did.
But we're only
because it's paying off sort of the Berman setup of the first couple episodes.
All we've been told is season one is going to be one kind of big arc. This is episode 9 of 15.
It's the Spore Drive arc.
Okay. So I totally see where you're coming from. I just don't necessarily think that this is the conclusion of the Klingon War.
Okay. So, well, it's going to be interesting. I mean, we're going to have to wait a little while to find out.
Yeah,
but
January.
This episode didn't fill me with, like, confidence that, like, man, there's so many more exciting things left to do with this Klingon War.
Right.
Not that there was that many exciting things along the road anyway.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, most of the Klingon War stuff that we saw on the show really didn't have to do with the war. It was about Vok and Laurel being off on their own.
But I like the... I'm not so interested in the story stuff. It's the character stuff that I like, and that's the stuff that worked for me.
Yeah.
Speaking of character stuff, we should probably talk about the Stamets and Dr. Hugh Culber stuff going on.
Right.
First time we ever saw a man-on-man gay kiss in Star Trek.
Right.
Noteworthy, obviously, we had the Kelvin versus Sulu established as gay. But I mean, we've seen other stuff like with DS9 and Rejoined.
Yeah.
But this is different, you know, and that's we're finally, I think, Star Trek's finally catching up to the 21st century, which is kind of embarrassing that it's taken this long. So, but again, I mean, like, if I had not already known it already, that there had not been any sort of this stuff, like, previously in Star Trek, I would not have thought twice about this. They just, and I think that's, I think the reason why this relationship has not been sparking a lot of the kind of, negative reaction that we were very fearful of is because it's
ridiculous outrage, you mean?
Ridiculous outrage. But it's because it's been portrayed as very normative as opposed to, like, oh, this is a very special episode.
Right.
And I think, like, just from, like, the kiss between these, like, two men that love each other. It's,
not only that, how do you not like these two characters?
Oh, I know.
Like, to me, it's like, how do you not like these two?
Because I love the fact that they're, like, just on complete opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And, like, you're like, okay, yes, opposites attract.
Yeah.
Stamets is still, like, one of my favorite characters on this series.
Right.
I think Culber, I'm kind of, like, I don't know what season two spells for Culber, because do you think Stamets at this point is making it all the way to the end of season one?
I have no idea.
I honestly thought he was going to die in this episode. Did you get that sense?
I did, actually. I don't think he's going to die. I think he's going to be okay.
Okay.
But I am hoping that Culber, they figure out if they want to use this character for what he's being used for now, where he just kind of, like, pops in to kind of solve medical problems.
I know.
Or if maybe in season two he becomes a main cast member, which I would totally be down for.
I just hope that they maybe learn lessons from Ash Tyler and, like, just kind of give him more to do.
Right.
Like, because I like the actor a lot. So far I like everything he's been given, but, like, he doesn't really stand out to me like a character like, say, Tilly does.
Right.
You know, so I just want them to give the Doctor more to do. I'm still, like, in utter awe of, like, how awesome those medical uniforms look. Like,
yeah.
Just the white, and I was thinking
it. You're wearing one right now.
Yeah, it's, I made it myself. it's pretty much just, like, butcher's paper that I wrapped around, you know? It's kind of embarrassing. But, the other thing, like, we haven't really seen them much, but do you notice, like, some of the uniforms, I think most of the engineers wear them, and some of the medical staff, but it's the short sleeves.
Right.
I really dig the short sleeve, like, Discovery uniform. Like, that's,
I like
me,
all the uniforms on this show for the most part.
Yeah.
I've been a big sucker for almost all of them.
Even the Admirals, like, because they have, like, those special deltas wrapped around their insignia that I'm just like, oh, okay.
It's interesting. In the book, Desperate Measures, they say that the crew of the Enterprise are all wearing the classic uniforms, because only Constitution-class vehicles have crew members that wear those uniforms. So I'm wondering if we're going to see a point in the series where they seg into those uniforms.
I'm skeptical.
Or if they just keep it that way.
I think they just keep it, like, the way that they have.
There's
it.
Enough of a time gap. You don't have to.
The other thing is, like, I'm just thinking about purely budgetary perspective.
Yeah.
Like, uniforms or like costumes, far more expensive than you would ever think just to produce all these uniforms. And for them to, like, toss... What, between the main characters and all the extras, what, you probably have like 50, 60 of them,
right,
like, out and about there?
Yeah.
I think you're looking at, like, what, like maybe 200 grand that they're just going to flush down the toilet?
Do we ever see characters maybe pop up wearing those type of uniforms?
That I would dick.
Yeah.
If, like, do you think we'll ever get to see a Constitution class starship? I'm not talking about the Enterprise, but do you think, you know, there would be a chance? What was the one that's we saw in or like the USS Defiant was a Constitution class?
Do you ever get to see? I don't see why not. I think you have to at you some do point. Think,
but okay, but is it going to have like that visual reboot that we've been witnessing so far in Discovery? And is that going to cause a lot of complaints?
We live in the age of HD TV, so they're going to have to kind of redesign it just to look like it fits into sort of an HD world, I think.
But beyond that, do you think that is it going to look closer to like a Kelvinverse Constitution class than classic?
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I'm okay with it. Don't care.
I'm okay with it. What do you think the general fandom's going to be like?
I don't want to know.
Yeah. Would you be up for seeing would you prefer to see something like the USS Defiant? Or there's been a few other Constitution class starships that we saw throughout the original series, but would you want to see one of the old ones or like an entirely different ship that we've never seen before?
I really don't have a dog in this fight. Like, no? I'm cool with whatever. Like, if they even want to throw in just an Enterprise scene where it's docked somewhere, you know, like, I'm cool with that. Like, I don't really mind.
Well, I don't know. I'm fine with that, but yeah. I don't want to look at social media complaints about it, and I'm just like, to me, it's not worth the stress of listening to fans just, like, moan. Oh, I'm just like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, honestly, I don't really mind either way.
Okay, so Cam. Nine episodes in. You know, we're more than halfway through. This is a mid-season finale. We're coming back. How are you feeling about Star Trek Discovery at this point?
I really feel like I'm on a high after this episode.
Yeah.
Like, I really just enjoyed the hell out of this episode. And I'm not going to lie, I was a little concerned after last week's episode, which I guess would have originally been the mid-break finale.
Yeah, I know.
Because they ended up adding an extra episode onto the first half.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine if last week's episode had been the finale?
I think we would have been really bummed out.
This would have been the worst podcast, just like miserable.
Well, I don't know. I would not describe last week's episode as miserable, but we were definitely underwhelmed.
But if this had been the finale... Like, this is what, well, you know, this show may be in some trouble, folks, you know.
and I would have said that I would not have been nearly as excited about coming back in January as I am right now.
Right.
I am very excited about coming back in January.
Yeah, like, I feel like they ended on the perfect high going into the next season. I mean, there's you know, no bones about it that the show has...
It's Dr. McCoy.
That this show has, you know, it's had a few stumbles along the way finding itself, as every Star Trek series has. But I think it's gonna go interesting places.
Strange New Worlds. or as when Lorca said to Stamets, you chose to boldly go where no one has gone before.
The journey continues. I mean, I feel like we are going to be going places that are interesting, which I'm excited about. And, you know, last week's episode was kind of a bummer. I thought, oh, no, like, they're already kind of running out of gas this early. But
I never thought of it that way. I just thought of it like this was kind of like, a one-off kind of like...
But it didn't feel like a one-off, because the way it ended, I'm like, oh no, it's like the battle for the Povans.
Yeah, it didn't really turn out to be the battle for the Povans.
No, thank God.
Thank God, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know, like, I just... This episode ended on that perfect note. I look at the series up to this point, there's like maybe two episodes I'm not that crazy about, but like 7 out of 9, you know, I mean, 7 out of 9 of good to really, really...
Is that a Star Trek joke?
It's not actually intended to be, but it is now. It's, you know, 7 out of 9 episodes are good to like really, really good. I don't know that we've hit great yet. You know, we haven't had our Inner Light episode or something like that, or our, Balance of Terror episode, where I'm just like, holy smokes, like, that is top tier Star Trek.
Yeah.
But we've gotten close. You know, we've had some really great episodes.
I would say this early on into the series, if this is a series that goes on for 7 seasons, I'm very happy with the creative direction it's going. I think maybe during this mid-season gap, you and I will probably take like a look back at, kind of give a mid-season report card and take a look back.
Maybe things to improve on
There's definitely issues that I have with the series.
Yeah.
But, I mean, overall, I'm satisfied with what we've gotten. And it's crazy to think that it's been more than a decade that I was watching Star Trek week to week after, like, the 90s, which was just crazy, where it's just like... Yeah. There were weeks I was watching like two new episodes of Star Trek every single week.
Yeah.
I was just like, holy crap. And then you go and have a decade-long gap of absolutely nothing. And we're doing this. And you and I, we're excited to be doing the podcast like every week. Like, this is fun for us. And listeners, it's a lot more work for us.
You have no idea.
You have no idea. But
and I've been excited, too, about the series, even if there's elements of it that maybe are a little bit predictable.
Yeah.
The way they're delivered always sidesteps my expectations to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Like, I never tune into the next episode and watch it and be like, oh, that is what I expected. Like, it always has a weird twist on what I'm expecting.
Yeah, you're right.
And you don't watch the previews for the next week, but I usually do. I don't think I watched it for this week. But even what they show there is not delivered on in the way that I would have expected from the teasers.
All right.
So it's a show that is being very secretive, but I think in a way where it's delivering in the sense that, like, it is giving me something that always surprises me.
Yeah.
And I'll take that over, like, I mean, how many episodes say, like, they would have a preview for one of the more generic TNG or DS9 where there's, like, you know, a virus is loose on an alien planet. And you're like, oh.
I can kind of guess what happened.
Yeah, yeah, I can figure out how this one's going to wrap up. This show isn't doing that, and that's exciting.
I think the go-to is the one where Bashir and O'Brien ended up on that planet in the Gamma Quadrant that had that virus.
Yeah.
And Bashir had to come up with, like, some sort of
cure. Yeah, to save O'Brien, right? Yeah. Didn't he get it? I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah,
I just remember there's like they had like these like either red or blue spots on their faces. And I was like, oh God.
I mean, there's a lot of virus episodes. You mentioned Miri earlier.
We should probably do a virus episode. Like, yeah, best and worst viruses.
Why have we not?
I don't know.
Maybe that'll be in the break between between the two halves of Discovery. There's one to count the days to, listeners.
Sure, yeah, listeners. Our virus, best viruses.
Best and worst viruses.
No, I go back to Harry Kim and the disease. Spoiler alert.
That's always the worst.
All right. So, Cam, any final thoughts before we wrap and get over to some of our other housekeeping for the week?
I don't think so. I'm just honestly really anticipating the return, which is awesome.
I'm excited. This is a good thing to have, you know? Yeah. Like, we can lament the demise of Cole. But other than that, like, I'm very happy where this series is right now.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, they've killed some characters so far, and every one of them I think I've been bummed to see go.
That's good.
Yeah, that's a great thing because, you know, they killed characters on other Star Trek series where I didn't care that much.
Yeah, so what? We've lost to Kuvma, Georgiou, Landry, Cole. Those are kind of the big four.
The big four, yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, Cam, why don't we talk about the Ortonville report this week?
I've been counting the moments.
I know. Well, this is the episode Cupid's Dagger.
That's a very, like, TOS title.
It's very much kind of a Star Trek sort of episode in that you would not believe this, Cam, but it is a huge homage to DS9 fan favorite Fascination.
Oh, okay.
So in this, we have Rob Lowe's character.
Is he playing the Vedic Borel character?
Kind of.
Really? Oh.
Well, in that, like, this guy's not been seen since the series premiere.
Right.
He was the alien that was kind of the...
Oh, of course.
That Kelly Grayson, the first officer, was having an affair with.
Right, yeah.
Against Ed Mercer. And,
I totally forgot Rob Lowe was in that.
Yeah. And look, Rob Lowe, I always love him in whatever he's in. So he was great in this one, too. But crew members, I mean, they're overcome with lust during a diplomatic assignment, which causes problems with this diplomatic assignment. And, well, Ed Mercer, I guess this is supposed to be a very progressive moment for... the Orville or science fiction, but Ed Mercer has like gay relations with the alien. And the problem is like, oh, hey, we're the Orville. Look how progressive we are. The entire thing is like, the entire joke is like, oh, now like it's gay. And it's just like, you're supposed to laugh at the fact that he is like a supposedly heterosexual guy who's having like gay relations with this alien. And like, right. It's just like, no guys, you're missing the whole point of like Star Trek, where it's like, if the alien was a woman, there would be no punchline to hit on. And so you just have Seth MacFarlane hamming it up with like going like, come on here, come back to bed, you.
Right.
And it's like, oh God, I just find the Orville so tone deaf in like how it's supposed to be emulating Star Trek's ideals. But you've got the frat boy Seth MacFarlane humor. And so it's like, as progressive as this episode's supposed to be, it's just like, no, it's just going back to like the entire joke is like, oh, like, isn't it funny that like two men would have sex? Like, isn't that a big joke, guys? I'm just like, oh, God. It just makes me, like, feel like you're just missing the mark on everything here. Whereas you watch an episode like Discovery where you just have, like, this completely normative homosexual couple and, like, nobody bats an eye because it's completely normative. But this is like, oh, look at them. They're having sex. And it's like, oh, God. Like,
you know, I don't want to comment on Seth MacFarlane's personal politics because I don't know him. But he doesn't strike me as someone who is well suited, from everything I've seen, to be tackling progressive concepts in his work. No. He just doesn't seem like that's his bag at all. He always has to have that sort of, but then, sort of that kind of like elbow you in the kind of the ribs. Yeah. Kind of, he's not comfortable being earnest. He's not an emotional storyteller.
So why would he choose to do a complete homage / ripoff to Star Trek then, when it was all about kind of the whole point of the franchise is that it is earnest. And we see that with Discovery every week.
What does he like about Star Trek? That's the question. Everyone takes different things from all you know, franchises.
He keeps talking about the optimism of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he just seems so tone deaf. And like it really genuinely bugs me that like the entire joke was like, oh, look, it's two men.
Right.
Like there would be absolutely no joke to this concept if the alien was a woman.
Right.
You know, so I'm just like, like it generally irks me. I say that, Cam, this is probably the third best episode.
Oh,
like,
really?
It's actually like one of their stronger, like, and considerably stronger than what we've seen the last few weeks.
Right.
So I say that, and it seemed like a classic Star Trek episode in which there's like a diplomatic mission going on. So
I'll have you know, on IMDb, the ratings for the episodes, almost all of them are higher than the Discovery episodes.
How did Cupid's Dagger fare versus other episodes? I'm just curious.
It's,
to me,
it's at an 8.2.
What are, say...
The highest I see is If the Stars Should Appear, episode 4, which has an 8.5.
Okay. Oh, that one?
Yeah.
I hated that one. That was the one with Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
I hated that one so much.
Yeah. I think the lowest reviewed was the pilot.
Oh, to me, I think that was probably their first or second best.
Yeah. But,
oh,
you know,
I'm getting at...
Discovery, I don't think, has an episode that's hit over... It's never beat the sevens.
Wow.
I think...
Star Trek fans are a fickle bunch.
This week's episode has, but... It had an 8.2, I think, before it aired.
Oh, God.
So that means it's going down.
Okay. All I'm saying is, I just based on those ratings that we're seeing for various episodes of The Orville, this is clearly not the show aimed at me.
Right.
So, I hate coming back and just begging on the show every week, because I know that there's a lot of big fans of it, but I'm trying to be critical of it because this is such an obvious homage to Star Trek, and a lot of fans and a lot of love goes into the series. I just think that it's not, they don't quite get what makes Star Trek a special sort of entity here.
Right.
And but they're trying their best. It's essentially like kind of a high production budget for a fan film.
Well, you've only got 4 episodes left.
Yeah, which is fine. Like, look, it's not torturous to sit through these episodes, but right. I just think it's not Gene Roddenberry's vision, as people always like to
Of course,
say.
Of course.
Anyway.
Now, we don't really have any feedback this week. I think that says more about last week's episode of Discovery than anything, because it just didn't seem like an episode that people really want to talk about.
We're just even looking at, like, say, the number of views we got on the blogs and all that, and it's just kind of like, number of impressions we got on Facebook, and it just... I don't think this one gripped people.
No, because like the episode Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, we got a lot of feedback off that episode. Yeah. So, you know, it just shows that, you know, a weaker Discovery episode doesn't lead to a whole lot of feedback. So that's not a surprise. But I want to thank Brett Stowes for a great review he gave us on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
This goes out to all of you. Please go over to the Facebook page and give us a review, 4 or 5 stars. please. Please. Yeah. And, you know, it just helps with us getting, you know, ratings on Facebook and what have you.
I'd also say if you go to facebook.com/subspacepod, it's actually good for our listeners in that, like, we're posting a lot of exclusive content that you're not going to get just from listening to the podcast. Yep. We mentioned the blogs a couple times. We're also posting, like, videos, which are separate from the podcast, and we're having a lot of fun with the videos, too.
Yeah, and the videos are not recaps of the episode.
No.
They're their own thing.
And we also have, you can access episode commentaries that we've done for some fan favorite and not so favorite episodes.
Right.
So yeah,
and we'll have a poll going up, I think, for the next commentary.
Yeah.
We'll be doing in the next few weeks.
So guys, just you're missing out if you're not on Facebook following us there.
Well, and while we're here, Tyler, why don't you just talk about what your blog was about this past week?
Yeah. Well, with the most recent episode, I'm gonna try to remember it. CV. Packham Parabellum?
Sure.
I compared it to the episode Strange New World from Star Trek Enterprise.
My favorite episode of all time.
Which, to me, on rewatch, it wasn't nearly as torturous to go through, but I still don't think it was a very strong episode.
Right.
But I'm in awe of how, as much as we kind of like, we didn't really deride the previous episode, but we weren't big fans of it.
Yeah.
I was absolutely mesmerized by their depiction of a so-called strange new world. I think it was like one of the best we ever have seen in Star Trek, certainly among the television iterations of new planets.
Yeah.
Because no offense, I mean, I've been to Southern California, a very nice place, but like there's only so many like brown hills and like quarries I can look at in Star Trek where it's just like, yeah, this looks pretty much like the same everywhere. And we got Strange New World from Star Trek Enterprise. It was our crew's first, the NX-01 crew's first experience on kind of a planet. Well, I guess they did stop at a couple planets in Broken Bow.
Yep.
But it just like, you're supposed to be captivated by what they were seeing. It looked like it was in Southern California once again.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, this, I mean, they're filming this in Toronto, which, I mean, whatever. I mean, I think it was actually to their detriment that they did not, if they're going to film this in Canada and get the tax breaks here, Vancouver and British Columbia has far more diverse sort of geography than Ontario does. And
right.
We literally have deserts in the southeastern parts of the province. We've got rainforest. We have glaciers, like giant peaks.
Yeah.
So whatever, but you know, I was mesmerized by what we got to see through the Pavo planet, and I hope there's even more of that to come with kind of the lush landscapes to experience.
Right.
So I kind of compared what we were seeing between those two different episodes, and had a lot of fun about talking about pollen versus spores.
Right.
So, there you go. Cam, what did you write about this week?
Yeah, I talked about CV Pacem Parabellum. And its similarities to James Cameron's Avatar, which were probably pretty obvious to most of you who watched the episode, just given the way the planet Pavo was presented with its sort of phosphorescent foliage and things like that. It was very Avatar. But there was, you know, some other themes there, too, with sort of the character who goes native, which is an old trope. And it was just very intriguing to me because Avatar is a movie that made, insane. I think it's the most financially successful movie worldwide still. And it doesn't feel
not counting inflation.
Of course, right. No. But, you know, Force Awakens has beaten it domestically, but I don't believe it has worldwide. And Avatar is this movie that, like, everyone saw. It, you know, ushered in 3D. It had big impacts on the way, you know, effects movies are made. But it doesn't feel like anyone ever really pays tribute to the storytelling and characters and world of Avatar. So I thought it was very fascinating to see Star Trek seemingly paying homage and very earnestly to a movie that no one really seems to reflect on.
Or care about.
Yeah.
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 And I just, like, almost a decade later.
Yeah.
What is the cultural impact of Avatar?
It's the effects in the 3D glasses.
Yeah.
You know, that as far as really I can tell.
The most vivid thing I can recall is helicopters and floating kind of islands.
Sure. And when I say the effects, it's more that they were an evolution of effects. We were already seeing, you know, like Jar Jar Binks and, you know, the Star Wars prequels started that ball rolling majorly. And we just saw Avatar sort of a next step. But since then, we've seen them get better and better. So
who's our Jar Jar Binks of Star Trek Discovery so far?
Harry Mudd.
Sure.
Okay. Oh, yeah. And so, yeah, I just thought that was interesting. I don't know. Maybe the Avatar sequels will really help the cause of Avatar. I don't know. But that'll be a different blog for a different time.
You know, every time somebody doubts James Cameron, he shows them why he's James Cameron.
Right.
So I'll go see these, four or five movies at this point? I don't know.
Four. Yeah, four more.
Four more?
Yeah. Okay.
I'll go see all of them, but I'm not excited.
No, me neither. Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed this podcast, jump on over, as Tyler said, to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod for more content and discussion and all of that sort of stuff. Hopefully there's going to be a lot of discussion going in the break. You know, where's Discovery going when we come back? And I think it's going to be a lot of fun of trying to forecast where the series is going to go in its final six episodes. So
I like to say lorecast.
Wow. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, Cam, we spent this episode, at least the start of it, talking about biggest badass moments in all of Star Trek and how this tied into Star Trek Discovery. We've actually been talking about doing this one for a while, but most badass characters in all of Star Trek. And there's a lot of characters that kind of pop to mind.
Yeah, because, you know, I mentioned at the top of the episode, you know, like the Riker fire was on our badass moments.
Yeah.
But is Riker a badass character? That's where it gets interesting.
I think he's a very charismatic guy.
Don't give it away, Tyler. Oh, spoilers. Yeah. Spoilers for next week.
But I'm saying there's a lot of very badass characters in Star Trek that we can get into. And it's going to be a fun one between you and me, like going back and forth here. So I don't miss that one. And it's going to be weird. You and I, we're going back to kind of our old sort of...
Format
for at least the next a couple weeks. So
yeah.
I'm intrigued. We can probably, you know what? Maybe this is pulling the curtain in front of listeners to a certain degree, but we can knock out a couple episodes in one night and keep them in the bank for a little bit. But it'll be interesting to get back to our regular sort of pace.
And also be able to draw from Discovery episodes.
I'm really excited about being able to do that now. Because that's actually what I've been waiting for ever since Star Trek Discovery premieres. It's like, oh, now we're able to go and think about how this fits into the canon and ties into all these other episodes we've been doing the last 3.5 years. Can you believe it's almost been 4 years since we launched the podcast?
I know. It's terrifying.
Crazy.
Time flies.
Okay.
I'll be contemplating my own mortality soon, like Picard or Kirk.
That's a Star Trek trope.
I feel young.
Time is the fire and must be burned, Cameron.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam B as in victim of Klingon torture Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reporton. N is in nude Klingons.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.